Welcome to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by ancient language and biblical scholar, Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevahscrossing.com. Lecture 5, By Word of Mouth. Up to this point.
So far, I've tried to get the course underway by talking about religious ideas. The fact is, all of us have opinions about religious questions, even when we do not consider ourselves to be particularly religious. The conclusion I hope you draw from this fact is that everybody ought, therefore, to be interested in determining whether or not their opinions are correct. You don't have to decide whether or not you will have religious opinions. You do. The only thing you need to decide is whether or not your religious opinions are correct or not. This, in turn, I hope, will help develop in you some interest in the course independent of the fact that you have to take it. I would like you to see the course as an opportunity to do some thinking about religious matters that you might not otherwise do, and to learn some techniques and develop some skills for doing this kind of thinking. It seems to me that, at least working within a broad theistic context, we must know whether or not there is a God and what He is like before we can do any intelligent thinking about religious matters. Therefore, I raise the question very early in the semester, do you have any information about the existence and character of a supreme deity? Now, nearly all religions give an affirmative answer to this question. They say, yes, we do have that kind of information. I suggested in the last lecture that in the concept of the incarnation, the Christian faith gives a more satisfying and full answer to that question because it says God actually became a person. He appeared among men. He permitted them to see what He was like. He made pronouncements on controversial questions. He left behind, among His followers, an understanding of what He was like. Now, if this is so, then we have in the Christian faith a fuller disclosure of the character of God than any other religion affords us. I don't even have to argue that the true God is passive, but that He actively lived among us. I think in most other religions of the world, He doesn't get a chance to do very much. But God is always trying to get through to people. And if He doesn't have the Christian religion to work in, I think He'll use whatever He's got and try to get through to us. So I don't have to argue that God is not in any of the great religions of the world. I do think I can argue that He has done more to show Himself in the Christian faith than in any other religion.
Editor's footnote. Now, all of this is to say that although the Christian God is not recognized in many other world religions, He nevertheless does try to reveal Himself in a variety of ways, even without the explicitness of Christianity or even Judaism. One such way is through nature. But there is also evidence from stories told that He reveals Himself through dreams and visions.
Now, it is this claim that God became man at a particular point in time and space that we are going to examine, and in particular, we have to ask what evidence is there that this report, a report of what is really a historical event, is true. Our question then becomes, what is the evidence that the narratives of the New Testament, especially of the Gospels, may be regarded as trustworthy? Earlier, I pointed out four general areas in which uncertainty might arise, and I propose that we address our attention in the next couple of weeks to each of these four areas in turn. First, the events of Christ's life may be dated about 30 AD. This covers his life, 2 or 3 years previous to his death and the resurrection. And as it happens, the Gospels, the four Greek writings which give us most of our information about Jesus, do not seem to have been written down until about 30 to 60 years after the events. This leads us to the first uncertainty about the Gospels, and we are proper to ask the question, during this time that the stories are being passed by word of mouth, did they suffer exaggeration? We will cover this topic this morning. Second, although the original manuscripts were written sometime between 60 AD and 90 AD, we don't have the originals. I can hope that perhaps one of you might become an extraordinary explorer and find them. So pay attention. I'm going to tell you what you should be looking for. This gap between the events and the original writings, about 30 to 60 years, we might call the information gap. We wonder, where were these stories during that time? When were they written? Were they set down accurately or not? Where did the writers get their information? The discipline of source criticism, which we will cover in the next lecture, tries to answer that question. The third area of uncertainty is that we don't have the originals. What we do have are copies, the earliest fragment of which is about 130 AD, and the first full copy about 350 AD. The gap in time between the original writings and the copies we have of them, about 70 to 260 years, we might call the copy gap. That's a long time. Doesn't that totally leave us in the dark as to what the Gospels originally said? The question becomes, what did the original manuscripts say? The discipline of text criticism, which we will also cover later, tries to answer this question. We'll do that in lectures 14 and 15. Finally, the fourth area of uncertainty, how did the early church select these four Gospels out of a large number of writings which it produced in the early decades and centuries of the Christian church? Was a correct selection made, or were some documents left out, which should have been included? We will cover this in a lecture on the canon of the New Testament in Lecture 15.
First area of doubt, accuracy of oral transmission.
That brings me to the leading topic for our lecture this morning. When you begin to appraise the reliability of the New Testament, that is, the historical stories, we are confronted at once with the probability that these stories were not written down at the time they happened, but were committed to writing some 30 to 60 years later. During the intervening years, they were circulated by word of mouth only, orally, from person to person and group to group. This means that when we begin to talk about the trustworthiness of the New Testament, we have to consider this period of oral transmission and ask ourselves about the faithfulness with which the stories were transmitted. I want, first of all, to talk about the probability that there was such a period as this. Secondly, to explain why it was so. And third, finally and most important, to discuss a series of safeguards that ensured accuracy in the transmission of the stories during this particular time.
How do we know there is an information gap?
All right, first, how do we know there was this information gap? How do we know when Mark was written? Right away, we have to say, Mark doesn't tell us when it was written. There's no copyright date, obviously. And you have to make some deductions from what you read in the Gospels, all four of them, and in Mark particular. You have to make some deductions to help you know when these things are written down. Now, it's generally agreed that Mark was written first. I'm not going to defend that at this point, though it will turn up later in some of our discussions. The date for Mark is generally 60 to 70 AD. And here are some of the reasons why it is assigned to that time. First of all, the time of the events which are reported. Now it tells of events that are supposed to have happened around 30 AD. It therefore can't have been written earlier than 30 AD. I mean, this is how you decide when something was written. Suppose you stumble across Mark in a cave someplace, and you had never heard of anything that was in it before. How would you decide when it first appeared? Well, it can't have been written before the events it reports. Moreover, there are two or three little touches which strongly suggest that it was written within the lifetime of people who witnessed these events. There is this funny little story in Mark 14:51 through 52, which describes that at the time Jesus was arrested, someone was with him on whom the soldiers also laid hands. This person, who is not named in the gospel, managed to wiggle out of his garment and escape into the night in the nude. Now, that's an interesting little touch. What you wonder is why it's in there, and who the guy was, for another thing. Now, a lot of people think that probably it was Mark himself, and that's how come he knew that, for it's not the sort of story that gets in general circulation. And if this is the writer himself, then of course the gospel was written down during the lifetime of people who witnessed it. Also in Mark 15:21 it says that Simon of Cyrene was the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, who are these people and why are they mentioned? Why drag Alexander and Rufus into it? Well, they must have been men who were known to the people who read Mark when it was first written. This means that the two sons of the man who was there when Jesus was crucified were in the audience for which Mark was first intended. Well, that's just a guess, but it seems like a valid one. This suggests that the gospel was written not before 30 AD, and within the lifetime of some persons who were alive when the events happened.
Where did the information gap come from?
Secondly, why can't we date the Gospel of Mark, therefore, right away, that is, 30 to 33 AD? Why do we have to shove it later on? An answer to that is the audience for which the Gospel of Mark seems to be intended. It was not for a Palestinian audience, because Mark must explain Palestinian coinage. He tells us that two copper coins make a penny. That's in Mark 12:42. Now, you don't explain that if you're writing for people who are Palestinian Jews. You explain it only if you're writing for somebody who doesn't know what kind of coinage is in circulation. For example, if I write a letter to a friend in England and I want to describe a bargain I bought, I can't really do so in terms of dollars because he doesn't know prices in terms of dollars. I'll have to convert it to pounds and shillings. But if I write the same bargain to somebody in this country, I don't have to explain that. And if you've got hold of my letter and didn't know who it was for, and you discovered that I was explaining that so many dollars are the equivalent of so many pounds and shillings, you would have a good idea that I wasn't writing for someone who lived in the United States. In the same way, the Gospel of Mark explains Palestinian coinage and therefore must have been designed for somebody else. This is why Mark explains traditional Jewish ceremonial customs and why he translates Aramaic expressions. Aramaic was the mother tongue of Jews in Jesus' time, the 1st century A.D. It's very similar to Hebrew, only Hebrew was not spoken by Jews and had not been for several centuries, except in religious settings. So we conclude that Mark was written for someone who did not understand Aramaic, someone who was not a Palestinian Jew. The conclusion is that the Gospel of Mark arose late enough in the early church because Gentile audiences needed an authoritative summary of Jesus' activities. 2nd and 3rd century traditions connect Mark's Gospel with Peter in Rome. And if this is correct, that the Gospel of Mark was designed for a Roman audience rather than a Palestinian Jewish audience, it seems that it must have been written not earlier than the 50s, for we do not have any evidence of Christians in Rome before the 50s, certainly not a whole community of Christians in Rome who would need an authoritative summary of the deeds and words of Jesus.
The Mark and Peter connection.
Finally, there are some traditions about Peter which connect the person of Mark with Peter himself. Clement of Alexandria says that Peter authorized the writing of Mark's gospel. And another church father, Irenaeus, says that Mark was promulgated after Peter's death. Now, the date of Peter's death was about 67 AD. He was executed by Nero. And this brings us, you see, to the 7th decade of the 1st century, that is, to the 60s. Now, there's no airtight case here, but it's the kind of literary detective work that people are always doing with ancient writings. And these are the reasons that Mark is dated in the 60s, generally, and are the reasons why Mark is regarded as having not been written at the time of the events. The date of the composition of Luke and Matthew is generally believed to have been later than Mark, since they apparently used Mark as a source of information. More on this later.
Why were records not written down on the spot?
It seems incredible to us, with on-the-spot TV cameras, that the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus should have taken place and nobody even bothered to write it down for 30 years. At least 4 reasons may be suggested for this. First, the habit of teachers of religion in Palestine. The Jewish habit for many decades was to memorize rather than to write down. The student did not make a synopsis of the teacher's work. He only quoted the teacher word for word. The rabbis emphasized, "You memorize first, you understand it later." They taught by oral drill. That is not a dental technique. Oral drill means that the teacher would make a statement of religious truth. The students would repeat it after him, word for word, until the entire class knew it by heart. The job of the class was to memorize the teacher's words exactly as they were given. Later on, they could understand what they meant. The first thing was to memorize them. As far as we know, all the rabbis from the Old Testament period on used memorization to teach the great body of rabbinic teaching, which was not committed to writing until after the destruction of Jerusalem by Roman armies in 70 AD. That is, people just didn't think about writing down. If you wanted to know what Jesus said, you learned it by heart. That's the way it was done. Second, as long as eyewitnesses were alive, the written records were deemed inferior. Who wants to read about it in a scroll when there's some guy who saw it happen and can tell you about it? It was when the eyewitnesses began to die or be killed that people realized the importance of written records. Third, the early church was preoccupied with travel and evangelism. Even Paul, who wrote more than any of the writers of the New Testament, wrote on the run. He had to squeeze his epistles in, such as when he was in prison, for example, and other situations. But if you are writing on the run, you are not in a situation that really is conducive to the patient and meticulous research which must go into a statement of historical events. It may be that Paul can write religious admonitions and advices on the run, but how can he put down what Jesus did in any detail? Fourth and finally, there is some evidence that the early church expected Christ to return very soon. Therefore, the collection of data and the writing of books would be much less significant than preparation for his return. If they thought Jesus was coming back within 25 years, why bother to write things down? Tell as many people as you can and be ready for him to come back. So, for these reasons, it seems that the writing down of the stories about Jesus was not deemed important until the 60s or the 70s of the first century.
Oral exaggeration.
Now, this raises a real problem for us in connection with the accuracy of the New Testament. We know how easily stories become distorted when they are told repeatedly. We have caught ourselves doing this, making over our own experiences as we tell them, so that each telling is a little better than the one before. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered between November 1946 and February 1947, they were found first of all by an Arab goat herder named Muhammad Edib Hassan, or Muhammad the Wolf. He had gone wandering down into the gullies looking for his sheep and thought they might have fallen into this cave. And when he got in there, there were the scrolls. Well, everybody was very interested in this because they'd like to know if there were any more. Several years after the scrolls were discovered, someone got Muhammad Edib to tell his story on tape in colloquial Arabic. Then it was transcribed from the tape, and I saw a publication of it. The Arabic text with an English translation of Muhammad Edib's story. By that time, he had told the story many, many times, and the editor of this particular publication pointed out certain little touches that made you think Muhammad Edib had improved on the story as he went along. For example, you can't be sure, but one of the things the editor pointed out was that Muhammad Edib saw this cave up in the side of the gulch and thought maybe the goats had crawled up there and had fallen in and couldn't get out. So he threw a rock up in there, and he heard it rattle against something hard. So he clambered up and went in. And here were a lot of these tall clay jars. The scrolls were first discovered in tall clay jars about a meter in height. He says that there were 10 of them, and each had lids. He went around and he took off the lid of each jar and looked inside. I think in the first one he took off the lid, and when he looked inside there was nothing. So he took off the lid of the second jar, looked inside, and there was nothing. And he kept going. Finally, in the 10th jar, there is the scroll. You know, maybe it wasn't the 10th. Maybe there were 10, but maybe he didn't have to look in all 10 to find the scroll. This sounds like the kind of thing that you gradually develop over many tellings in order to make a good story even better and help build up suspense around the campfire. So for now, how do we know that this didn't happen to the stories about Jesus when they were being told by word of mouth only for these 30 years? I also suggest the analogy from the childhood game of gossip, in which somebody whispers something at the end of the row, and you whisper it rapidly to the next person. And by the time it's gone around the 10 people, it comes out totally transmortified and unrecognizable to the person that started it going. Once again, how do we know this didn't happen to the stories about Jesus?
9 safeguards to accuracy of oral transmission.
Well, there are a number of safeguards to ensure accuracy of oral transmission during this period, and I want to spend the rest of the time this morning in talking about 9 of them.
Safeguard to accuracy of oral transmission, number 1, repetition.
First of all, as I've already suggested, in connection with the reasons for not writing down, teaching among the rabbis was always by repetition. This kind of teaching, known from rabbinic writings, was probably also practiced by Jesus and by Jesus' followers. A Danish scholar, fortunately writing in English, has done a very thorough study of this whole question in his book, Memory and Manuscript. The college library has this book, and any of you that are interested in exploring the question of oral tradition will find Gerhardsen's study very interesting indeed. He shows that the rabbis had a lot of explicit techniques to make sure that what they taught would not get changed in the process of repetition. For example, the rabbis say, "A man's duty is to repeat a passage to his pupil 4 times." Or, "A man's duty is to repeat to his pupil until he has learned," which may be quite a different thing. Or, "A man must repeat until that teaching is well arranged in his pupil's mouth," that is, until it comes out the way it should. Again, speaking about the matter of memorizing the lesson, the rabbis say, "The man who repeats his chapter 100 times is not to be compared with the man who repeats it 101 times." Or, "The tireless rabbi is praised." Or, "Rabbi Perdita used to repeat every passage 400 times for a dull pupil, and once for an especially dull one, repeated it 400 times more." The chief measure to counter forgetfulness, therefore, was continual repetition. The first psalm speaks of this. "The ungodly are not so," it says. "He delights in the law of the Lord, and in this law does he meditate both day and night." But the Hebrew word for meditate does not mean so much think over and over, but rather it means to mumble it under your breath. What the first psalm praises is not thinking about God's word, but saying it over and over again to yourself. This shows you that from time immemorial, teachers in the Near East have practiced this kind of technique, teaching by repetition. Gerhardsen further writes, "Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai, who lived from 30 AD to 90 AD, knew the time of day from his recitation. He had been in prison and it was dark, and he couldn't see where the light was. Somehow he knew when the day started, and he was so accustomed to reciting stuff that he knew that he could tell when it was noon by the point where he was in his repetition. Rabbi Shesh ben Shelsky repeated everything he had learned every 30th day." What's more, they taught that you had to repeat what you were learning aloud. You couldn't get by with a mere whisper. There was one story about Rabbi Eliezer. Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was a prominent Judean sage of the 1st and 2nd century and disciple of Johann ben Zakkai. One of those pupils repeated what he had learned in a whisper only, and the result was he forgot everything he had learned in 3 years. Another teacher corrected a pupil who repeated it in a low voice, saying that learning was assured only if it was fixed in all 248 members of the body. I don't know where he got his figure of 248, but all right. So the custom in the Near East was to teach by repetition. This begins to help us see that the stories about Jesus and the teachings of Jesus were communicated to people in a context which put great emphasis on learning exactly. Nobody would think he knew what Jesus said until he had memorized it. It's so different from our situation, but that's why it seems to us as though things would easily have been distorted when it was not so.
Safeguard to accuracy of oral transmission, number 2, mnemonic devices.
2, the rabbis, and I think Jesus himself and his followers, made use of mnemonic devices. Mnemonic devices are those which make something easy to remember. You may have heard that the spaces in the treble clef are F-A-C-E, and that's easy to remember because it spells face. Or that the lines in the treble clef are E-G-B-D-F, every good boy does fine. Those are mnemonic devices which make it easy for you to remember stuff that would otherwise be hard. Now, the rabbis of the time and Jesus himself used mnemonic devices in their teaching. For example, there is what I may call
A. Semitic parallelism.
Now, Semitic applies to the people of the ancient Near East, the Jews and their neighbors. I was going to say they are cousins, but it doesn't sound right in the present political situation. But the Jews and their neighbors in the ancient Near East, the residents of Syria, Mesopotamia, and so forth, these people have always been called Semites. Semantic parallelism is how a lot of the teaching of the rabbis was couched in poetic form. Poetry is always easier to remember than straight prose. For example, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder where you're at." But you know right away that's not the right word because it doesn't rhyme. The word at should be are. And if it matters, you keep working at it until you get the word that fits. Semantic poetry is not characterized by rhyme, at least not by the rhyme of the word, but rather by a device in which the same idea is repeated in slightly different words. For example, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein." That's from Psalm 24, 1 and 2. Now the second verse repeats the same ideas found in the first. "The world" repeats "earth," and "they that dwell therein" repeats "fullness thereof." That is a completely characteristic unit of Hebrew poetry in which there is no rhyme of sound. But as it were, the thought rhymes. The second line repeats the first. I once heard two little kids talking, and one was saying to the other, "What word rhymes with yes?" And the answer was, "Uh-huh." Now you see what's going on there. The second little girl had taken the meaning and given a duplicate for the meaning, rather than a duplicate for the sound. She may be a Semite, because that's the characteristic of Semitic poetry. The next time you read the Psalms or the Prophets, or next time in church and there's a responsive reading, look for this. You will find this repetition in verse after verse, especially in the Psalms and the Prophets. Jesus uses this also when he says, "Ask and you will receive." And then he repeats it. "Seek and you will find." And repeats it again. "Knock, and it will be opened to you." And then he starts over again. "For everyone who asks receives." Repeat. "And he who seeks finds." Repeat. "And to him who knocks, it will be open." Once you get the pattern, how can you forget it? And that's the point. Teaching in this way constituted a mnemonic device, making it easy to remember. Again, "Do not give that which is holy to dogs," said Jesus, and repeated it, "neither cast your pearls before swine." Or, "You will know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns?" Repeat. "Or figs from thistles?" The use of semantic parallelism makes it easier to remember.
B. Grouping in threes and sevens.
This was a favorite device of the rabbis generally, to rattle things off in lists. Almost anything they were talking about would become an excuse for listing three something or others and seven something or others. And when you came to that point, you had to learn how to rattle those things off. A lot of times, some of the things in the list didn't have anything to do with the first thing. But the rabbi wanted you to be sure to remember all these things, so he gave you the list. Now, in the rabbi's writings, you never find things in fours or fives. You find them in threes and then again in sevens. There's something special about these numbers for the ancients, but the trick is this. If you can get more than three, you know you've got to go to seven. And that way, the groupings of things in groups of threes and sevens helps to remember exactly what the rabbi taught you. Now, I don't find very many sevens in Jesus' teachings, but there are a lot of threes. He groups things together in threes over and over again. That ask, seek, knock example, which I just gave you, serves as this point also. Psalm 1:1 says, "Blessed is he who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stand in the way of sinners." Repeat. "Nor sit in the seat of scornful." There you see both Semite parallelism and the pattern of threes.
See, parables, metaphors, and similes.
Finally, religious teachers in ancient Palestine made generous use of pictorial devices, parables, metaphors, and similes. The rabbis of Jesus' time and before and after told parables. They did not tell them nearly so well as Jesus told them, and perhaps not so frequently. Jesus was a master at the succinct pictorial device to make something easy to remember. You know how often you will remember a preacher's story, even when you're not even sure what the point he was trying to make was. And when you can remember the point, you know how much more clarity is introduced into something abstract by the use of an illustration, even just an image, a metaphor, or a comparison. Now, the teachers of the ancient world probably did this a lot more than we do today. And you find in Jesus' teachings, over and over again, stories which make it easy to remember a point. What I'm saying here is that the use of these several devices makes it easier for the student to remember exactly what he was told. And when we find Jesus using some of these devices in his teaching, we can think, probably correctly, that he drilled his disciples and that the disciples drilled their own followers in later years, much the way religious instruction had traditionally been conducted in ancient Palestine. And therefore, insofar as devices of this sort were employed, it made it easier to remember correctly.
Safeguard to accuracy of oral transmission, number 3, the power of memory.
It is difficult for the 20th century Westerner to believe in the power of memory, even when it is developed and practiced, as we've been discussing. The ancients, however, without the ability or the money to write things down, trusted their memory much more than we do, and it served them much better than ours serves us. This has been verified in recent years. For example, there are no Jews in Yemen today. But possibly, from as far back as King Solomon, there were. In the last several hundred years, there was intense persecution of the Jews in Yemen. So occasionally a host of Jews would migrate back to Palestine. The most recent migration occurred in 1949 to 1950 in an operation called Operation Magic Carpet, where 48,000 Yemenite Jews came to the nation of Israel, which the UN established in 1948 after World War II. This left no Jews in Yemen as it is today. So the Yemenite Jews were cut off from their Jewish heritage for a very long time. During the years when they were making the pilgrimage from Yemen into Israel, these Jews, even the children, came out displaying incredible feats of memory of their religious literature, that they could recite by heart. They just knew it. That was all. That was the way they learned it, and they could give it back to you that way. And if you have ever watched little kids learn things awfully fast. What a pity we lose that facility. I don't know why we did, but in a context such as the ancient Near East, where memory was trusted, people were able to memorize things much better than we can today.
Safeguard to Accuracy of Oral Transmission, number 4, The Nature of Preaching.
Now, this is something I have to come back to later on, and I hope that you will hook on to this material, at least for a starter at this point. These things, the stories and teachings of Jesus, weren't told just as good anecdotes from which everybody could get a chuckle at the way Jesus handled the Pharisees. They were not told as stories for entertainment. They were told as part of the evangelistic program of the early church. This is because the church recognized that the really significant thing about Jesus was that he was there, and that he was God in person. Therefore, what they had to say was not so much what Jesus said, but the real essence was what Jesus did. This is God acting, and people were motivated to tell people what God did when he was among us, how he acted and reacted. And so the stories were told only because they were part of the evangelistic announcement which the early church was making. Now, if the stories are not true, class, then there's nothing really to the message at all. If the stories are fabrications, then there really isn't any message. There's nothing to proclaim. If the facts are not facts and nothing really happened, then there isn't any evangelistic message. And so there is a kind of built-in device to inhibit change of the stories in this nature of the preaching. Now the others are easier to understand.
Safeguard to Accuracy of Oral Transmission, number 5, The Public Nature of the Transmission.
Here is where the analogy from the old game of gossip breaks down. Because this was not a story told by one man to one man, but told by many different persons publicly to large crowds. As John R.W. Stott says in his book Basic Christianity,
a tradition adopted by the community would be safeguarded, as it could not have been if it had been handed down through a chain of individuals, however conscientious.
For example, suppose I tell one of you individually about this astounding thing that happened to me the other day, and then somebody else comes along and I tell that person the story, and then somebody else comes along and I tell them. And each time I'm changing the story a little bit to make it a better story. So I've told 6 or 8 of you in the course of a week about this astounding thing, but I've told each of you a slightly different story. Who knows what the truth is? But if I tell this class and 115 of you hear me, and then I tell it in Vespers again, and I change it, there are going to be a lot of people in that audience who will say, that is not exactly what he told us in class. Now the point is that the stories about Jesus were not told person to person as anecdotes. They were told to large crowds as publicly proclaimed events, which ought to make a difference in the way people live. And that puts a tremendous safeguard upon the stories not to change. Suppose the preacher changes it quite unconsciously and makes it a different story. There will be people who say, look, I heard you tell that a month ago, and it isn't the way you told it just now. What really happened? And so the public nature of the transmission is a kind of safeguard.
Safeguard to Accuracy of Oral Transmission, number 6, The Oversight of Eyewitnesses.
Now, all during this 30 to 60 year period that we're talking about, the church contained many people who were eyewitnesses to what Jesus had said and done. We err if we think Jesus' followers were only the 12 who were his elite disciples. There were many persons who were with Jesus during his earthly life. There must have been quite a number who were with him during the whole 2.5 years of his earthly ministry. And there must have been many others who witnessed parts of his ministry in different parts of Palestine. This means that when Peter stands up to tell a story to a given audience, there are likely to be people in that audience who witnessed the event firsthand. James Martin says,
"The way people talk about that period of oral transmission, you would think that the gospel material had wandered waif-like down the years without the guidance or protection of one single person who knew or cared anything about it. Not so. There were eyewitnesses alive when the Gospels were transmitted and written who knew what had happened."
And the same thing applies to persons who were unfriendly to the church, which leads us to
Safeguard to Accuracy of Oral Transmission, Number 7, The Knowledgeability of the Opposition.
Suppose, for the sake of argument, that Christian persons decided to let some exaggerations pass, even though they knew better. There were also persons in many of the crowds where Christian preaching was done who were unfriendly to the church and who were eyewitnesses of what Jesus had done. When we study the Gospel of Mark, we will see for ourselves how the Pharisees watched Jesus with unfriendly intent, hoping to trick him into saying something indiscreet or heretical. And if the Pharisees laid in wait for Jesus the way they did, we may be sure they laid in wait for Jesus' followers. Some of the same men who had seen Jesus and knew certain things would have been in the crowds addressed by the disciples. And if the Christians decided to let something by, you can be sure the enemies of the church would have been quick to pick up any error in the teaching. This is very impressive to me, the fact that the crowds contained hostile persons who would have known what was done. I don't see how the church could have gotten by with any significant exaggeration as long as there were persons alive who knew what had happened. Now you know how people today will go to certain meetings just for the purpose of finding fault with them. In fact, last year, when we had the new Christy Minstrels on campus, I clambered my way into the bleachers and sat down next to a student who shall remain unnamed, and he had a pad of paper with him. And he said to me, half in jest, "I want to write down every dirty word they say." And you know ministers who went to healing services or tent meetings or something like this just to find out what was going on and find fault and warn their congregation. And this is as old as old as old. They were doing it in the days of the early church. And if there were any attempt made to exaggerate, I don't see how the stories could have stayed in circulation.
Safeguard to Accuracy of Oral Transmission, Number 8, Inconvenient Items.
8 is what I call inconvenient items. It covers quite a number of things that we find in the Gospels, which show that when the Gospels were written down, the writers did not change the material that came to them.
A. Items which are embarrassing.
If the writers had been inclined to change what came to them, they would surely have illuminated this sort of thing. For example, the uncomplimentary references to the disciples. The best thing we can do is to look a few of these up and read them quickly. Mark 6:51, after Jesus' miracle feeding of the 5,000. At this, the disciples were completely dumbfounded, for they had not understood the incident of the loaves. Their minds were closed. They had seen Jesus' miracles, but they still didn't believe in him at all. Or Matthew 6:23, where Jesus refers to Peter as Satan. Hardly a compliment. Or Mark 10:35-37, where James and John are shown to be lobbying for special favors from Jesus and making the other disciples very angry. Or Luke 9:52, where the disciples, because they were turned away from a particular village, blew their tops and asked Jesus if they shouldn't call down fire from heaven and incinerate those inhospitable people. Finally, John 20:24, the skepticism of Thomas. Everybody else believed, Thomas wouldn't. Now, class, these items, uncomplimentary to the disciples, were put into circulation at a time when the persons named were held in great esteem by the church. Here is Peter, one of the leaders, and it turns out that there was a time when Jesus referred to him as Satan. He was that far off base. Now the point is, if somebody is inclined to change things, how do they happen to miss these? And the conclusion is they must have been willing to pass on what they found, even though it was uncomfortable or inconvenient.
B. Inconsistencies between the Gospels.
Now, there are differences and minor inconsistencies between the Gospel accounts. For example, was there one angel, Matthew 28:2, a young man, Mark 16:5, two men, Luke 24:4, or two angels, in John 20:12, at Jesus' tomb? But these differences, they are not contradictions, are really evidence that the accounts are genuine. It always amazes me that students regard the general similarity of the Gospels as evidence of their truthfulness, whereas the skeptic would regard them as evidences of collusion. For example, a student writes,
"It is unlikely that the Gospels would be similar in so many ways and yet not be true."
But it is the tiny differences that show the writers of the Gospels refuse to alter their stories in the slightest.
C. Reader familiarity with the tradition taken for granted by Mark.
Notice how Mark plunges right into his narrative without preamble of any kind, and quite plainly takes it for granted that the reader will know about what and about whom he writes. John the Baptizer is not introduced in Mark 1:4. This means the readers knew the stories about John the Baptist, and the writer could not have falsified them.
D. Passages not understood by the writers.
And there are passages not understood by the writers. For instance, in Mark 14:58, it says, "I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands." Or Matthew 11:12. "The kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force." That these difficult sayings were included shows the disciples' faithfulness to the tradition.
Safeguard to accuracy of oral transmission, number 9. The church distinguished Christ's teaching from its own.
Those critics unfriendly to the New Testament reliability mostly believe that the church must have altered these stories in order to have authoritative teaching in new situations. But Paul's discussion of marriage and celibacy in 1 Corinthians 7 is a perfectly good chance for him to pass off his own opinions as those of Christ. But he does not do so. He says plainly, "This say I, not the Lord." And again, "This says the Lord, not I." All right, now, I must stop here. Time has run out, and I've given you a great deal to think about, and hopefully I've been able to provide good reasons that what was written by the gospel writers years after the events took place were reliably documented. That's all for this morning.
Thank you for listening to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity: Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Thank you for listening.